The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. On this week's show, I'll have Jim with me in a moment, but we're going to discuss and, I guess, provide our thoughts and input to a recent article that came out entitled Eight Retirement Distribution Strategies That Will Make Your Money Last. And the reason we thought this would be an interesting topic for today is it lays out eight different ideas in how to manage your retirement funds. And many of them are what I would call traditional approaches. And we thought this was a good opportunity to kind of do a compare and contrast on how those traditional approaches might compare to how we tend to approach things. And we realized we hadn't really talked about or summarized our retirement philosophy and approach recently. So it gave us an opportunity to do that as well. So, Jim, thanks for joining me again today.
Thanks for having me, Chris, and Sure. Listeners. Thanks for listening. How are things up north? I'm down south today in my house. Things are pretty sunny here. Is it sunny up in Fort Collins?
Beautiful here too. I'm a little disappointed in what the outlook for Memorial Day weekend looks like here. We're heading.
Yeah.
We're going to try to do some camping, but we might be coming home early if the rain is as bad as they say, and the cold. It looks like it's going to be mid-40s.
So. Yeah, you know, they had, for those who don't know, folks, we're going to have a rainy, is this playing before or after Memorial Day?
This is playing after, so.
After, so, well, I hope everybody had a good Memorial Day, but Colorado is setting up to have a rainy Memorial Day weekend on Sunday and Monday, and they said on the news today, Chris, that this time of year, it's very rare for Colorado to have full days of rain, let alone two in a row. But I do want to point out, when I used to live up in the area where you're going to go camping, you bought the lot next to where I used to live. We used to hike every Memorial Day weekend, and we did a hike up Fish Creek, which is south of where you're going to be.
Yep.
And the area that burned actually just burned all last year, and Fish Creek is closed now. But we hiked from Fish Creek up to the CSU campus. And it was a cold, miserable, rainy day, and it rained the entire weekend. So it's not unheard of, even though it's rare. But that was the only other time that I can remember it being, for the whole weekend, just kind of a dank, rainy time. So it's not unheard of, but in the 23 years that I've been here, this is only the second one that I remember that it's supposed to rain.
Yeah, we're usually pretty safe for camping over Memorial Day weekend here, and this looks like we didn't win the lottery this time. But we're going to go give it a go because it's going to still be nice on Saturday. We'll just have to see what faces us when we wake up on Sunday, and we'll make the decision whether we're going to stay or not.
So. Well, the second time in 23 years, that's not bad.
True.
Alrighty, folks. Well, we don't want to bore you any longer with Colorado weather. What we are going to do today is what Chris was talking about. I had found this article yesterday, and I just kind of read it on a whim. It's not a very long article. It's not a very deep article. But as I was reviewing it, Chris, it's not that we necessarily feel the eight approaches that they're going to discuss and will review are in and of themselves wrong. They're just not the approach we take and the approach that we believe in when it comes to funding your retirement. We really, folks, believe passionately in a simple concept that we say the younger you, now y'all may not feel young at 55, 60, 65 years old as you're planning for your retirement and really putting the rubber to the road is the saying, right, Chris?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Putting the rubber to the road and saying, hey, I want to retire in a couple of years. Let me get these final numbers crunched. What we're trying to say for us when you're at that phase and you're trying to figure out how you're going to project your retirement, we believe that the younger you has an obligation to make sure the older you, the 75, 80, 85-year-old you, so you might not feel young at 65, but compared to 85, you are young. We feel the younger you needs to give a explicit promise or guarantee to the older you that the minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses will be covered forever, no matter what happens. And we believe that it should be covered with lifetime guaranteed income. In other words, Social Security, pension, and income annuities. And we strongly preach that, and that's what we do when we project the person's retirement. If they don't have enough secure income, Chris, who does all the retirement planning in the office, he will determine for you how much we feel you need to reserve. We're not saying to run out. You all know this if you listen to us a lot. We're not saying to run out and buy an income annuity to supplement your Social Security and pension if it's not going to be enough. We're saying the younger you needs to reserve that money, kind of mentally push it off to the side. Some people actually move it into a separate IRA or retirement account so they know it's off to the side. We believe in doing that all in a way to come up with what we call your fund number. Why don't you explain a little bit about our concept, Chris, of a fund number? Because our approach truly does differ, I would say, from 7 of the 8 recommendations. There's one recommendation that kind of does a little bit of what we do, but none of them mention our concept of a fund number. What do we mean by that?
Well, I'll see if I can kind of describe how we got there and what it is in a short way. That might be a little bit tough, but historically, and I think this is something that faces a lot of advisors and planners with clients that are doing retirement planning. A lot of times you'll run a retirement plan and you'll realize you need to or cut back a little bit on spending, or you are able to spend more than what you described or thought you could. And when that information is delivered, the natural question is always, well, how much? How much less do I need to spend on the things I can control? How much more? Now, when we say less or more, those are on discretionary type items, not your minimum dignity floor. It's not like you have discretion over, oh, my budget's too big, I'll cut my medical in half. It is what it is. It's not really, you can make some marginal adjustments to it by choosing different plans maybe or what have you, but it's nothing real significant. People aren't going to cut their food budget in half in order to try to make their budget balance. That really isn't discretionary. So what we're really talking about is adjusting the extras, the fun that you might want to do. And the question always was, how much more, how much less? And then it's kind of a dance back and forth, trying to negotiate and trying to adjust here, see what it looks like, adjust there. And took a lot of time to maybe kind of hone in on how much more or how much less it would be appropriate for their particular situation. So Jim and I, a long time ago, backed up and said, let's come at this a different direction. Instead of starting with a budget and then kind of adjusting it until we think it looks okay or it looks acceptable to a client, let's exclude for a moment all the fun spending. Let's concentrate on everything else, starting with the minimum dignity floor. Get it handled, get it covered with specifically an approach that involves lifetime guaranteed secure income to cover those expenses that must be covered till the very last days you're here on Earth. I jokingly say a lot of times if you could tell me when you're going to pass away, we don't have to worry about lifetime guaranteed income from a third party because we can budget around that if we know when you're going to pass. Well, people obviously don't know that. So that's why we like secure income for covering the minimum dignity floor. Then we look at other priorities you might have. Maybe carving off some money for a guaranteed inheritance. Maybe carving off for a guaranteed charitable donation. Maybe some aging expenses that you think you're going to incur because the living situation you're in isn't favorable for aging, or you don't have someone who can take care of you, so you're going to have to pay someone to come in and provide extra services due to your decline as you age, or long-term care needs, those sorts of things. Maybe if that's a priority, get those protected in some way, and there's a variety of ways of doing that. And then create, you know, any other priorities, honestly. Anyone who has priorities above their fun, deal with those first, and then look at what's left. What's left will be what Jim and I refer to as your fun number. Those assets that you have accumulated that have not yet been assigned a job that has priority over your fun. And priorities will vary a little bit from person to person, so not everyone's priority list is the same, but you need to decide your priority list, get that set aside or designated mentally or physically set aside, and then look at what you have left. And now you know what you can budget with. You've got now a budget presented to you instead of, you know, I wish I could do this, can I do it? The number's staring you right in the face, and you can now go spend that as rapidly or as slowly as you want, because the key here is instead of your giant pool of assets that have to cover everything, and now you're making all in your mind, you're thinking, my gosh, if I spend more over here, do I have to worry about not paying my utility bill? There's just so many variables, it's overwhelming trying to budget the whole thing. But when you carve it down to, and when we say the fun number, that's our playful way of describing a bucket of funds that are purely discretionary, that use of those funds will not jeopardize anything else that you've prioritized. So in other words, now that you're dealing with just the fund number, it's a much simpler negotiation. It's simply a negotiation between the younger you and the older you about who's going to have fun with this money. And for most people, they want to load it all up, or not all of it, but a significant amount up in what we call the go-go years, the early years of retirement when you know you're still young and healthy enough that you can go do the things that tend to be expensive. And you can put the pedal to the metal with this number, because worst case, you spend a little bit too heavily, you get a little bit low, you're just taking away a little bit of the fun only from later on. You're not jeopardizing minimum dignity floor or guaranteed inheritance or aging protection or long-term care needs, because all those have been handled separately. So, like I said, it's a little hard to describe the whole fun number idea quickly, but hopefully that draws the proper picture for you.
I think conceptually you did an excellent job. Longtime podcast listeners, this is all second nature to you. If you've been listening to us for a while, you either like us or you like our process or both. But I think if you're new, Chris just gave you a good description of our philosophy. And I'm glad you picked up, and you always do, because for you, Chris, this is a big issue. You don't like people dying with too much money. To you, that's as big a failure as dying with not any money right. left.
Unless you're and one that, of the very few that's your goal. A few people do have that. We want to, you know, we have no real needs for ourselves. We live simple lives. Our goal is to leave as much possible to our kids and grandkids. Those people actually are few and far between, at least contacting us. Maybe they're not contacting us because our whole approach is designed around not leaving you with a lot of money, allowing you to enjoy that nest egg that you've built in a way that is safe, but as maximizing the enjoyment in the early years as possible.
Exactly. And if you wanted to leave an inheritance or maximize anything, you've already carved that out. But for our fun number concept, folks, that we don't want you to die with any of that. to me, any fun money left over is life unlived. I've said that before. Remember when I said money left over is life unlived? And then I said jokingly that when you die, your last check should bounce. And a few listeners took that literally and actually took me to task and sent us some emails saying, hey, we don't want to live that close to the line that we die with at, right at the perfect time with nothing left.
I think that day we just weren't quite as clear that we were talking about just the fun number bucket specifically.
Right. So by breaking it all out, we call that positioning in our practice. And again, these are concepts Chris and I have developed over the years. They are not concepts that are widely practiced in the industry. And you're going to see that when we go through these eight distribution strategies. Most of them, Chris, revolve around treating your portfolio as one big portfolio, not breaking it out. And I think, well, I don't want to get too far ahead of me. So let's begin with the article. And we just, again, we are not saying if any of you are practicing these strategies, we are not saying that there's anything inherently wrong with them. It's just not an approach that Chris and I favor. We favor our approach. And you'll understand why as we kind of go through this and pick some of the statements that are being said and explain to you why we either agree or disagree with them.
Yeah, if we If we review back to the title of the article, I just want to remind everybody, it was all about strategies that will make your money last. And I agree with Jim. All these things that we're about to hear as he lists them are things that will tend to make your money last compared to if you did something more risky than what they're describing in this particular case. What they're leaving out is the part that we find is very important. Make your money last and enjoy your retirement as much as possible. That's the part that I think gets dismissed a lot of times here, and you're going to see that in these approaches.
Exactly. So a couple of rules we're going to follow. We are not going to name any of the advisors or any of the firms. Sometimes they quoted a firm, and sometimes they quoted an individual advisor. We're not going to name any of them because they're not on the show with us to provide an opposing opinion, not to defend themselves. Because again, anything they say we don't feel is inherently wrong. It's just not what we practice. And we can't have a spirited debate with them or discussion with them because they're not on the show. Mm-hmm. So I just don't think, Chris, it would be fair to name them.
Okay.
So we're only going to describe the processes that they're recommending or the strategies that they're recommending. And we'll mention their quotes or their reasoning, but we just won't mention them. Okay. So the first one that they spoke about, which is the more common approach...
Very common.
And it is the definitely the most common approach. But before I get to that, I do want to mention the very first sentence. I totally forgot that. The very first sentence of this article is pretty poignant, folks. It says, saving money for retirement is only part of ensuring a financially secure future. The other half involves making smart decisions about withdrawing that cash. What are they saying in English? In English, they're saying accumulating your assets is only half the trip to retirement. Decumulating them is the other half.
And I would say in complexity, the accumulation is simple compared to the other part, the distribution phase. Because accumulation, in my opinion, the biggest hurdle there, the thing that makes it most difficult to do is making the decision and committing to doing the savings over a long period of time. If you do that, assuming you don't make any fatal, terrible decisions along the way, it's going to be hard to not amass money for something like retirement. You just have to commit to doing it early enough and keep doing it over a long period of time. And lo and behold, it works. So the other, when they say half and half, I would say maybe time-wise, it might be kind of half and half, but effort and complexity-wise, the withdrawing the distribution phase in retirement is underestimated in complexity as far as the number of decisions you need to make and what you have to do and how easy it is to do something wrong that might not cause you to completely fail, but would cause you to not have as good a situation as you otherwise might.
And I fully agree. I 100% agree. And that's something that we try to drive home, not only to our podcast listeners, but to clients who decide to work with us. Amassing your assets, to me, I don't think anybody even needs an investment advisor during the accumulation phase. And
you probably,
please, if you're an investment advisor,
probably just
don't
heard
send
gasps
me nasty.
Out in the podcast world.
don't send me nasty emails. But what I'm getting at, folks, when you are saving, when the only cash flows into your portfolio are positive cash flows, and you are saving for retirement, I'm not talking about saving for something 5-10 years into the future. I'm talking you are in your 20s and 30s and 40s, and you're going to need this money in 50 years, 40 years, or even 30 years from now. What does it matter if the market is going down during that time frame? Seriously, it is literally a sale. And your positive cash flows into that portfolio, your accumulation cash flows, are just buying equities at lower prices. That's going to benefit you later. It's a sale. Yet the industry, the investment advisory industry, makes it so complex, makes it sound like you definitely need them. And the goal for a 33-year-old Chris is to make sure their portfolio doesn't drop. Or if it drops, it only drops enough where they're sleeping at night. To hell with the portfolio. If you're freaking out over it, you need to have a discussion. If you're in your 30s, remember that gentleman who wrote to us, the young person in his 30s? He panicked last year in March, and he sold at the bottom, and he only watched the market recover. And we spoke with him on the show. We didn't speak to him personally because he was saying, how do I get back in? What do I do? He had saved hundreds of thousands of dollars, folks, by his, he was either in his early or mid-30s. And he panicked in March when COVID hit, March of last year, and he took it all out of the market at the low, practically, he said, just before it rebounded. He should have just left it and kept buying. He's only in his 30s. I think an advisor can add value there. That's more emotional and behavioral finance value. But value on investing? I'm sorry, advisor alpha is what the industry calls it. Is very rare in that, in my opinion, at that point in your saving life, low cost, passively managed, well-diversified, buy and hold strategy, that's what you want. And all you Vanguardians out there, you know that. You've amassed hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars on your own. So I do question the value at that point. But when you get to the top and you're starting to go down, you're starting to decumulate your assets and spend, that negative cash flow, that simple change from a positive to a negative cash flow is literally as stark as flicking on and off a light switch. They are two totally different scenarios, are they not, folks? You go into a darkened room, and then you flick the light switch on, it's a totally different room, it's a totally different view, it's a totally different situation. It's that stark, on, off. When you start spending for retirement, if you use the rules, the diversification, the asset allocation, the portfolio design, all the rules you use to accumulate your assets and your wealth, all you Vanguardian do-it-yourselfers, if you take those same rules and think they are going to get you through retirement with negative cash flows, you're kidding yourself. And you also have to keep in mind, as you go through retirement, you are not getting younger, stronger, and healthier. Your body is not getting stronger. Your mind is not getting full and full and fuller with knowledge. It's the total opposite of your 20s, 30s, and 40s, and even early 50s. You have to understand that. Your body is going to age. Your mind is going to age. Your ability to understand financial concepts declines. We talked about that repeatedly. But more important than all of that, negative cash flows to your portfolio nullify all the accumulation rules you were using. You can still use some of those rules or a byproduct of those rules, but you have to take a different approach. And that, Chris, is where I feel the industry drops the ball on retirement planning. They still try to, all of these strategies, not all of them, but the vast majority of these strategies, Chris, do what? In my opinion, they are trying to put a square hole into a round peg.
Or vice versa.
They are trying, huh?
Or vice versa.
What are you talking about? That's the same thing.
No, there's no, you don't put a square, you don't put a hole in anything.
No, you can't. It's someone trying to do something that is not designed for.
I know.
Don't tell me that's not a saying.
No, the way you said it, it's not. It's you don't put a square peg in a round hole. You said you were going to put a hole into something. You put something in the hole, not the hole into something else. You were really close.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but you just got me off track, and now my mind is.
The whole point of these, I will admit, I know exactly where you were going. These approaches that are listed here, and now, I mean, we've taken 25 minutes, and we haven't listed one yet. Bear with us. It's coming very shortly. These are all approaches that traditional asset management from accumulators, what they're trying to do is solve the issue that Jim just brought up, that the portfolio doesn't behave properly when you're using those methods when you're withdrawing money. So what do? Constrict the withdrawals sufficiently enough to overcome the fact that you haven't optimized the portfolio for distribution. That's the essence of, I think, the heart of what's wrong with most of these approaches. Will that work to make your money last? Yes, it may. Not guaranteed, but it may. That's what we meant at the top where we said these might work, right? We're not saying they won't work. But what it does is it probably unnecessarily constricts what you're taking out to actually enjoy yourself in retirement, which is clearly not at the top of the priority list for advisors that use these approaches. Just my two cents.
Exactly. Okay. And I still don't know what you corrected me on, but you'll have to tell me later. Okay. So let's get to the actual strategies that they talk about. And you'll notice, folks, all of them, again, as Chris just put, try to take an accumulation portfolio. A lot of investment advisors don't either know, acknowledge, or quite understand, unfortunately, you can't use accumulation planning in a distribution portfolio. But also, Chris, let's be honest. Distribution planning and asset management is tremendously complex, far more work. It's difficult to put someone in just a simple model and manage it and take 1% of assets under AUM structure as they distribute assets. Mm-hmm. It's far more work, far more effort. That's why our firm only specializes in managing assets in the distribution phase. Our whole process revolves around that. Our whole strategy, everything we do, revolves around helping people spend their money, not necessarily accumulate their money. And I think they are just trying to keep what used to work going. So let's look at the first one, folks. It's the 4% rule. Y'all have heard that. It's the most famous one of all from Bill Benjamin years ago. I think somewhere in the 90s, he came up when spreadsheets first came out, and he started crunching numbers. And he came up with something that just has refused to die over the years, and that is if you take 4% of your portfolio out in day one of retirement, adjust those distributions for inflation, that is considered a quote-unquote safe withdrawal rate, and you should die with money left over. That was the whole concept mm-hmm. that they were doing. And when you research it or look at some of the writings on it, Chris, I'm sure you've seen this, and they use Monte Carlo projections with that spaghetti graph. Mm-hmm. All of you guys should have seen that. It's just tens of thousands of different lines, and then there's one in red that shows the median of all of them. But they show all these potential outcomes with any conceivable mix of portfolio and equity returns. And then they brag, Chris, at how large some of those portfolios are worth on the day the person died.
Right.
Look at this. When they die, they got a 56% chance of having more than $6 million. And they think that that is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be to people whose life goal was to work their entire life, save some money, not spend it, die, and give it to someone. Mm-hmm. There are some people who strive for that. And if that is your goal, you're not going to like our approach. But I cringe when I see that, Chris, because to me, it's saying you're not spending enough. And the reason they can't tell you to spend more under the 4% rule and say, well, you should be spending 6, 7, 8, 9%. When they do that, the probability of success drops all the way down into less than 70 or 60% sometimes. And who's going to want that? So that's why I disagree with the 4% rule, but they did say the 4. And in the article, they acknowledge that. They acknowledge that sometimes people are dying with a massive amount of money. Mm-hmm. And they say you could, some people are saying, according to the article, that you could take 10 to 15% out. And then they quickly follow with, but that's not recommended. And in fact, they quote someone else who says you should only take 2 to 3% out. So what is it, folks? 2, 3, 4, 10, 15? I think trying to guess what a safe withdrawal rate is and then constricting your lifestyle around that, I don't think that's a way to retire. I think that's stupid. I'll just say it. I think it's stupid. You should be breaking your expenses out. You should be assigning your assets to those expenses that are non-negotiable. You want to take care of them. Anything that's left over is your fun money. And I don't care how fast you spend that. I just want you to spend it. And we believe during your go-go phase, when you have the health, inclination, desire, and abilities to continue to spend and have fun, that's when you should spend the majority of it. Right. Anyways, do you have any other thoughts on the 4%?
I will just say that both Bill Bengen and then subsequently, which, you know, this whole fascination with Monte Carlo simulations came after that. Not that it didn't exist before that, but application and personal finance was really came after that. Bill didn't use Monte Carlo in his. He took essentially, instead of hundreds and hundreds of hypothetical scenarios, he took about 30 scenarios looking historically at returns that happen, and he looked at, you know, in the worst 30-year period, what is the most you could take out and not run out after 30 years. And that's where he came up with the 4% rule. It actually wasn't super sophisticated. It was an interesting way of looking at it at the time, and that's where he, you know, gained all this. I'm not diminishing his announcement. I think it was a value at the time. But even his approach focuses only on the chance of running out and not the possibility of leaving way too much money behind, which is also a failure in our book. And so both the Monte Carlo approach and the Bill Bengen 4% rule, which he's now, I think, dialed a little bit. He's admitted that he's adjusted it personally. He's still alive. Pay too much attention on the running out. Now, I'm not trying to dismiss the concern there. We know that retirees' number one fear is running out of money. But if that's the only thing you're concerned about and nothing else matters, a lot of these approaches will protect against that. People are so focused on that because, and they react to questionnaires from people, what's your greatest fear of running out of money? Well, here's how we're going to protect that. They should be asking, well, if we can protect that, but still maximize how much you can spend in your go-go period, would you be interested in that? We would hope so, because that's the approach we take.
And that's, again, folks, why we believe in covering your minimum dignity floor, which are expenses you will have to pay for the rest of your life, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, with income that will last for the rest of your life, irrespective of if your portfolio runs out or not. That is the pinnacle of our approach. And one other thing before we move on, the 4% rule, and Bill even admits this, does not account for taxes or investment fees, including the fees you would pay an investment advisor. If you have an investment advisor taking 1% of your assets under their AUM model, your 4% is already a 3% because he just took 1% because Bill did not account for investment fees and taxes in his analysis.
That's a good point. And you might think, oh, that's, it's just 1%. That's a quarter.
It's 25%.
It's 25% of what you could have been taking out and spending.
That's why I laugh every time advisors say, well, I only charge 1% of your assets. To hell with what that is. You look at the return of your portfolio, or in your case, what they're letting you take out. You're going to pay someone 1% a year to manage your assets who tells you not to take more than 4% out of your damn portfolio? He's going to take a quarter of what you're allowed to take. Hell, I'll give you that advice for half that price. And that's a joke. I'm joking there. It's we don't manage money that way. It's just it's insane, Chris. But anyways, let's move on. I digress. Okay, so the next one, which is kind of common sense, limit your withdrawals to just income. That worked great in the 70s. Of course, you had high inflation as well. Hell, in 1981, you could have got a government bond for 30 years paying you 18%. Wouldn't that have been sweet if you bought a 30-year government bond in 81 paying 18%? Limit your withdrawals to just income. What's the problem with that, Chris?
It's also constricting your ability to use the money that you built up for your own pleasure and enjoyment. This is another one. Let's just keep the valves open so little on the outflow that we protect against running out. It's all still focused on beyond all other things. Let's make sure it doesn't run out. To hell with anything else to be considered. That's my personal opinion.
And a byproduct of that approach, just live off of interest, which is impossible to do in a low interest rate environment. And the other reason I don't like it, Chris, is it carries on this notion that your principal, your savings can't be touched. When the hell did you save it for?
Right.
You can't touch it. You can only live off of what your savings can generate. To spend it is horrendous. It's you should be drawn and quartered and tied and feathered if you touch your principal. I think people who preach that, Chris, keep looking at retirement portfolios and calling them investments. I keep telling you people, all you podcast listeners, you Vanguardians who listen to us, stop when you retire. Stop calling your investments at that point. You have to emotionally get over the coddling of your portfolio and the growing of your portfolio. Emotionally, you're not going to like watching your assets drop. All you do it yourselfers, you're going to hate watching the assets you created drop. So you're going to appeal to, wow, just live off of income and my money stays there and I can continue to invest it in all these Vanguard funds and go on the Vanguard forum and chat about how well I'm doing. And I'm just going to live off of my interest because that's what you're supposed to do. You have this emotional block on spending money. It's as if you were a vegetable gardener like I am. And when it's time to harvest your tomatoes, you go out and you're looking at your tomato plant and you're loath to harvest them because they look so pretty and you don't want to get rid of them. And what happens if you don't harvest the damn tomatoes? In less than a month after that, they're gone because the plant dies. Well, the person dying here is you, not a plant. And you start having this money and you can't spend it. So what you all got to do is start looking at your portfolio and calling it what it is. Deferred spending. It's not an asset. I have deferred spending this money. I put it over here. It grew some, but I intend to spend it later. Because if you didn't put it in your IRA or your 401k or your TSP, if you didn't put it aside, you would have spent it in your 30s, 40s, and 50s. You put it aside so you don't spend it. There's only two things you can do with money. I mean, literally, you can do a few more things with it, but you either save it or spend it. You decided to save it, but then you're loath to spend it. And I think this live off of interest carries that emotional block on, Chris.
Yeah.
So then there is what they call the total return. This is number three on their list. It's saying, hey, don't just live off of interest, kind of expand it. Live off of dividends too. Now, I would think most people are smart enough to realize you're going to have stocks and bonds. You don't just live off the interest of the bonds. You would also live off of the dividends of a stock. But it does go further. it says that you should also take some of the capital appreciation, some of the capital growth, the capital gains. But still, Chris, don't go into principal. Although in that section, they do say that some people will also, as if it's a horrendous thing, will also go into principal. In other words, spend the interest, the dividends, the capital gains, and then they concede that's all part of the 4% rule, which is duh, of course. If you're going to live off of 4% of your portfolio, you're going to live off of interest, dividends, cap gains, and principal if you need to take some principal to equal the 4%. So I don't think that that's any phenomenal bit of advice there. It's just saying, hey, don't just live off of interest. I think our grandparents, Chris, going back into the 70s, I remember with my Nana when she used to babysit us when I was just a little boy of 4, 5, 6, we would walk to the local bank with her, and she just would tell me that she's going to cash in her CD and buy this other CD. I had no idea what the hell she was talking about. I only went because the bank would give me a lollipop.
Yeah.
But I remember going with her to the bank about CDs. But back then in the 70s, interest rates on CDs were 8, 9, 10, 11%. Mm-hmm. And you could put money in there and live off of it, but you can't anymore.
Yeah, you do that. You're doing the 10% rule without even touching principal. If you're able to get 10%, that's a totally different environment than what we're in now and likely to see. You can't plan on that. And even back then, it didn't last. It's something that it's not like you, because she happened to be retired in the 70s, early 80s, when interest rates were high, there was no guarantee that those rates would continue indefinitely throughout retirement, and they didn't. And definitely since then, we have not seen those kinds of rates return. So that's, you know, definitely a risk there that people should be aware of. Also, I'll point out, now that you're talking about dividends are not guaranteed. I don't care how long and how old the company is, dividends can be cut, can be reduced, can be eliminated at any time. There is no guarantee on dividends. So keep that in mind. A lot of people point to that and they build an income-generating portfolio, interest and maybe dividends. And they say, oh yeah, this is just, it's so robust, it's just always happened. Well, in times like this, when cash flows dry up for companies, there's tons of companies that reduced or paused dividends. Did your retirement pause? Did your expenses pause? Fund probably did recently, but your minimum dignity floor certainly didn't pause.
I agree. Okay, let's move on. We did skip over, I apologize, folks, if you're following along at home, if you Googled this article, right after 4% rule is actually fixed withdrawals instead of the 4% rule. Chris, you're going to take a steady amount of money every year. The problem with the 4% rule, well, it depends what type of 4%. If you're taking 4% of your account balance or 4% on day one and then increase it. But a fixed withdrawal amount is just what it sounds like. You're going to start, you're going to take a fixed dollar amount out, and you're going to continue taking that fixed. The point is, it still limits the amount of money you are spending. And that's where Chris and I disagree with this approach. You need to get a budget for your go-go years and spend that as fast. If you have a budget of, say, $600,000 for your go-go years, and your go-go years are usually the first 8 to 12 years of retirement. And I'm just making it up. You got $600,000. Chris and I aren't going to say, well, you can only take 4% of that out because that fund budget might run out. That's the point, is it not, Chris? For the fund budget is to run out, correct?
Right. Exactly.
So we don't care if you call us up and say, we're going to take 50% out this year. Okay, let me know what you're doing later because it sounds like fun. You don't know when you're going to die. You don't know when something is going to happen. You do know you're never going to get younger. You're never going to get stronger. You're never going to get healthier. We don't like to think about mortality, but it can happen at any time. You all know I'm living proof of that. I won't get into it, but you know what happened to me 5 months ago. It can happen at any time. So we believe once you come up with that fund number, once you accounted for everything, you're not going to take just a fixed amount of it every year, or 4% of it every year, or just the interest and dividends and capital gains it generates. You're going to spend it. Why? It's not money. It's deferred spending. Spend the damn money. Eat the tomato. That's what you grew it for. Okay. Next one, I think, Chris, I know you have this article in front of you. Mm-hmm. I think the next one is the closest to our strategy. Would you agree?
It has a key element that matches ours. It doesn't combine the two things that we do, but this is the first part of it for sure. And I will say that our approach to the first part, the creating a foundation or floor below which you cannot drop via what we call secure income, what most of the industry calls a fixed guaranteed income of some kind, is not an invention we came up with. And lots talk about that. Sometimes it's referred to as the safety first approach. They don't call it here. They call it create a floor. But it's very in line with our concept. We just have a very specific way of defining the floor. I think that's where we're unique, and they're not necessarily here, although they do refer to in this section building up enough guaranteed income to meet basic needs. That's a very short way of saying that basic needs to us are the minimum dignity floor. That's kind of our extension. We have very explicitly defined basic needs. Where, well, a lot of people might define it differently, but we've got a very clear definition in our approach.
I do like how they put, because they do in one sentence. I mean, they're as pithy as I am because they got it all in one sentence. They said a flooring strategy involves building up enough guaranteed income to meet basic needs. And that is true. One thing I did notice, the article, though, Chris, it gives only two options. It says delay Social Security or buy an income annuity. Doesn't mention pension. Now, does it not mention pension?
At the very top, it does. Yeah.
Say what?
At the very top. Guaranteed income, these include Social Security, pensions, and annuities.
Correct. He says it in the first line, right. But where they get into the flooring strategy, they only talk about delaying Social Security or buying an income annuity with a cost of living rider. Mm-hmm. I would have also, if I were them, put in there, consider not taking the lump sum payout on your pension. Take the pension. Mm-hmm. We see that all the time. And unfortunately, a lot of investment advisors, not all of them, but a lot of investment advisors encourage their clients to take the lump sum. The cynic in me says they do it because it's more money that they can manage. And if they're going to be able to charge 1% of assets on an additional $1 million that you might get as a lump sum, then they're going to get $10,000 more a year, and that could incentivize them to make that recommendation. I'm not saying they all do that, but I would say, Chris, in the industry, most of the time they counsel taking the lump sum, mm-hmm. not the pension. Whereas we are different. We look first at your minimum dignity floor, your secure income. We project the minimum dignity floor for inflation and the secure income for COLA adjustments if they're entitled to any. And we try to determine, will the older you need this income? The younger you may not want it. The young Vanguardian, the 63-year-old Vanguardian who loves investing money is just salivating on getting another $1 million, in my example, to invest and play with and have fun and grow. But the 83-year-old Vanguardian may not even exist. They may not even understand what Vanguard is, or just be fed up with it, not want to deal with it, and be thinking, God, if I could only have had some steady lifetime income. So we, again, tend to lean towards encouraging people to first make a determination before taking a lump sum pension. I would have just liked to see them mention that in the article, but they kind of skip over that.
Yeah, I think it's wise to always address the need for it in our approach. If you're following our approach, comparing it to your minimum dignity floor and combining all of your secure income sources and then seeing how good the coverage is by making certain decisions like when to claim Social Security, you can adjust it, and when you claim the pension, etc. Sometimes it makes sense to buy additional time in the pension to make the pension bigger. That's the exact opposite of taking the lump sum. You're actually feeding it more. That can sometimes make sense. Maybe the pension payout formula isn't particularly good, so it may not be a very good quality pension. or the robustness, the financial stature of the pension is weak. And there's some concern about what might happen in the future and whether or not there's some guarantees on it by the PBGC or you know, there's all kinds of factors that can certainly affect the attractiveness of the pension. But I do agree that the public has been trained, and I can tell this because of so many people just having the knee-jerk reaction, oh, I'm going to take the pension. I don't trust the pension. I don't blah, blah, blah. Give me the money. You know, because they see it as this huge amount. They're underestimating the value of a lifetime stream of income and have been convinced that it's better just to take the lump sum. So I think the default approach most people take is to tend towards the lump sum when given the choice. Some don't give you the choice, so it's not a discussion. But you should clearly have done the analysis to determine how attractive and useful is that pension in its current form as a monthly payout in your overall situation before you knee-jerk and take it out as a lump sum.
And always do that analysis looking through the eyes of a 70, 80, 90-year-old, not a 50, 60-year-old. You got to do that. I'm contemplating, as you all know, moving to Kentucky or Ohio, not because the 50-something-year-old Jim wants to live there, but because I think the 70, 80-year-old Jim is going to enjoy it much more than Colorado, and I feel the younger Jim owes it to the older Jim. Your pension distribution is no different. Don't just look at it through the eyes of a 63-year-old, say, who still understands finance and is into it. Look at it through the eyes of an 83-year-old. What are they going to want? Or even a 73-year-old? Nice, steady stream of income to cover expenses with no worries that lasts for the rest of your life? Or a constant portfolio that you got to manage? It's just kind of a trade-off. Anyways, let's move on. Next one, which is still kind of similar to what we sometimes, well, often preach. We just don't call it this anymore. Bucketing. The article was saying you might want to consider breaking your portfolio into different buckets of when it's called time segmentation is what it is. And it's, again, putting the money that you're going to need over the next X amount of years, 3, 4, 5 years, very safe. Then money you're going to need 5 to 10 years, a little bit intermediate, and 10 years or more invested aggressively. Bucketing. We used to talk a lot about bucketing. We don't use that term anymore, bucketing. I call it positioning instead. And we offer or have adopted a very similar approach to bucketing. We just feel it's a lot deeper than a traditional bucketing approach. Mm-hmm. My only concern with bucketing is it's often used in the insurance world to sell multiple types of annuities. So you got to be careful. Remember, we had a listener, we talk about that all the time, sent us an email when we talked about bucketing a few years ago. They went trying to find someone to help them put a bucketing strategy together for themselves. And they wrote to us and said they were just trying to sell me annuities. Mm-hmm. So you have to watch out. The word has been, or the concept has been, hijacked in the insurance industry to sell multiple types of annuities.
Yeah,
and again, if you...
I'd say what we call positioning is a specific type of bucketing would be the way to describe it. It's not a completely different thing. It's just that there's lots of different ways to do bucketing, and that's what Jim's talking about. There's a lot of people who are using the bucketing word that is very different one from another person using the same word, bucketing. So that's why we abandoned that word, because we're using a very specific approach to bucketing. There's an element of time segmentation, and that's very common. What is missing, I think, is I call it, what job does the money need to do? There's, in our positioning, it's all about two things. The way I describe it, Jim might describe it differently. Two things. What job does the money need to do for you, and when? Let those two things drive where you position the resources or money that is going to accomplish that. When and for what purpose? There's differences, and what I'm getting at is there's a difference between a money needed for minimum dignity floor in the future. Very, very important. That's in the future, so there's the time, and then the job is super critically important. Then there's money for fun in the future. Well, that's also in the future, so the time element is the same between those, but the job is very different, and that job may very well make it so it's appropriate to treat that pool of money or bucket a little bit differently. That's the way I describe it to people as far as how we deploy what is traditionally called bucketing, but we call positioning of your assets.
No, that's perfect. I call it asset liability mapping, income liability mapping, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
We help our clients look and say, okay, this money is going to be needed for this at that point in time. And Chris is 100% correct. We would often invest money being reserved for minimum dignity floor, perhaps a little more safely than money that we might be earmarking for a guaranteed inheritance. Oftentimes we see that if people are going to put $500,000 aside and say, this is for my three grandchildren. And we'll say to them, okay, do you want me to invest it aggressive? You're not going to touch this at all. We've crunched some numbers. You don't need this money. Your grandkids are still young. They need to grow. We need to be aggressive. And they're fine with it, Chris. Mm-hmm. But money that they might put for the older them needing in the future for minimum dignity floor, even though it still might be 15, 18, 20 years away from when we expect them to need it, they tend to err on a little more conservative side with that. Mm-hmm. So what Chris is saying is 100% accurate. Okay, next was minimize your required minimum distributions. I think this strategy should have been reworded do tax planning, because this part is saying, hey, you might want to look at not necessarily delaying your required minimum distributions forever. You might want to look at selectively start spending and do some Roth conversions if it makes sense to minimize your required minimum distributions so you don't have to take them in the future. I don't think that that's a strategy that will necessarily make your portfolio last longer, which is what the title of this article was. I think it's just sound tax planning.
It might help a little bit. It might help a little bit if you, over your lifetime or over a 15-year period into retirement, you pay less in taxes, because every dollar that you pay less to the government is another dollar you have left over to spend. So it might, you know, it's going to incrementally improve if you can find a way to extract the money from these accounts and overall pay less taxes, which is, you know, generally the goal of tax planning. So, you know, I could see where you could make an argument that this might extend the life of your resources if you were to do this compared to not doing this. But if you were, I would also then point out, if you're on the verge of running out, you've eaten through these assets naturally to the point where your RMDs aren't going to be very big. So they kind of go hand in hand, the fear of running out. And if you're actually on a trajectory of running out, your RMDs probably aren't an issue because you're probably taking the money out anyway. So I agree. This is probably the weakest of the attempts at extending the financial longevity of your resources.
And the next one is kind of related to it, and that's why the next one, they freely admit, has to do with taxes. But I still think the previous one was taxes as well. The next one is what they call account sequencing, folks. We call it a withdrawal analysis. In other words, put a little forethought. We usually do it every November, December for people. Put a little forethought into thinking for the coming year. How are you going to spend the money you're estimated you're going to need? How much should you take out of an always taxable account, a maybe taxable account, and a never taxable account? If you're a new listener, those are the terms Chris and I use. Always taxable is what we mean by that. IRAs, 401ks, 457s, accounts whose withdrawals will always be subject to income taxes. A maybe taxable account is what we call a brokerage account. The industry calls it a taxable account. I don't, because you might not pay taxes on it. Depends how you manipulate your withdrawals and your income. You may not have to pay taxes on that account. So we call a brokerage account a maybe taxable account. And then we have never taxable accounts. Those are Roth IRAs for the most part with qualified distributions. You will not pay taxes. So account sequencing is what they're saying is, hey, pay a little attention to what accounts you take the money from so you don't pay more in taxes than you should. And I guess what they're inferring is the less you pay in taxes, the more money you get to keep, so the longer your portfolio lasts. So I agree with that. I don't think that strategy in and of itself will solve your problems, but taken in conjunction, and the article does point that out, folks, we didn't mention it, that they don't say do just one of these. You should work, they say, with a financial planner who's going to employ any number of these strategies. Well, a good planner should always be doing what they call account sequencing and what we call withdrawal analysis. You should be looking at your accounts and deciding which ones to spend from. Now, if you don't have good tax diversification, and sadly, many of you listening to this podcast, you're in that boat and y'all know it. You've done a wonderful job saving. You got so fixated on saving, you weren't paying attention to what you were saving it in. And all of you are maxing out your 401ks like good little doobies because the government wanted you to so they can alien taxes later. And now you woke up one day and realized, holy moly, 90% of my money, 95% of my money is in always taxable accounts. Well, you can't do much account sequencing or what we call withdrawal analysis if 90% of your money is in an always taxable 401k. Right, Chris?
Yeah, and that's related to this. And I'm not going to name the advisor that they attribute this quote to, but I want to name the quote because this little snippet, this is a key rule or lesson in don't take the little snippet that might be general advice that applies to a lot of people and assume that it applies to everyone. The quote, save traditional accounts until that time later in life when you'll be in a lower tax bracket. End quote. Not maybe if you are, until that time and later in life when you'll be in a lower tax bracket. That makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up because I don't know how many people over the age of 60 this person's worked with, but there's a lot of people at 65, 70, 75, 80 are in atrocious tax brackets because they were excellent savers and saved a bunch, and they might have just done it primarily in these always taxable 401k TSP IRA accounts, and they're destined to be in a horrific tax bracket later in life. So don't assume you're going to be in a lower tax bracket later in life. You've got to look at the overall situation. Now, I agree, you may not know for sure. So the best advice we've got as you're kind of preparing for this over time, to the extent you can, create tax diversification for yourself. So when you do launch off into retirement, you do have the ability to account sequence, where in years where it makes sense, take more or less from different style of taxable style accounts to maximize your ability to spend your own money instead of sending it away in taxes. So do not assume that you're going to be in lower tax brackets later in life. You might be. Many people are not.
Well, since we're calling out, again, I won't mention the advisor, but above that quote, another person said something that made my hair stand on edge when they were talking about required minimum distributions. And they were mentioning that the RMD age has been extended to 72. And as some listeners have pointed out, which we didn't know at the time, there is a bill in Congress to extend it to 75, yeah, which I was surprised on. I don't know if that bill is going to see the light of day, but he is quoted as saying.
Yeah, this quote should be burned from the article and this person reprimanded for saying this, but go ahead.
Says, people hitting that age can look forward to a few more years of tax-free growth.
Oh my gosh.
That is, again,
it's not tax-free.
He's not here to state his point. But to me, that is horrendous. I would have worded it. People hitting that age can look forward to a few more years of creating an even bigger tax nightmare. You shouldn't just delay RMDs because you can. I just think it's asinine that they're talking about extending it. Who cares? If you need the money, you're going to take it. And if you don't need the money, I'm not saying the best thing is to defer it because right, it's only going to kick the can down the road. All of you people with 70, 80, 90% of your assets in always taxable accounts, y'all know that can isn't being kicked much longer. And you're starting to see the end of the road and you're going, holy moly, this was fun. This was fun my entire life. But God, the road ends. And then the can goes over the cliff. And you realize that ain't going to be pretty. So just because you can extend RMDs doesn't mean you should.
Right.
Anyways, just wanted to throw that bit out there. Okay, the next one is kind of a long description, but it kind of ties into some of what Chris and I preach. It says, match the right distribution method to each retirement account. So what they're saying is, I think a lot of this had to do, Chris, is when to start taking, because they talk about someone who quotes, some people would prefer to continue taking from their 401k long before turning on Social Security. And then they're saying, if you're going to do that, and there's nothing wrong with it, he said, you should take from a 401k prior to age 59 and a half if you retired from that job after the age, after the year you turned 55, because you can avoid like the 10% penalty. So I totally agree on that. You wouldn't take it from an IRA that you might be subject to the 10% early withdrawal penalty on if you have a 401k that you would not have to take the penalty on. So I think that's sound advice. What do you think?
Yes. That's often a reason to leave some of that, at least some of the money in the 401k from the company that you retire from, so that you can bridge that gap between 55 and 59 and a half without having to worry about early withdrawal penalties that do apply to other accounts, including IRAs.
Okay. And that, folks, was the 8 ways to keep your portfolio around longer in retirement. And what we wanted you guys to get out of this is that that's not necessarily the aim of retirement. You don't win by dying with the most. And all too often, I see that in financial plans colleagues put together. When we look, when someone hires us and shows us a plan they already have, or talks about the calculations they've already done, and looks at the probability that you could die. I love the probability statistics, Chris. You have a 80% chance of dying, and you could have as much as $6 million dying with outrunning out of money, and you could have as much as $6 million to as little as $400,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they're just telling you that that's a retirement plan. And of course, you're thinking, if you died with $6 million, did you win?
And some of you might be thinking of the fatal mistake, looking at that and saying, because I'm sure some of you are thinking this out there, and I know a lot of advisors think this way too. They're thinking, if I start heading down the path where I'm headed to that leaving $6 million behind, I'll just increase my spending. Well, by the time you're sure that you're on that path, it's too darn late. By the time you're sure you're headed for that outcome, or something similar, and you turn up the dial, you're 75 years old. Maybe can you go out and splurge and spend all this money that you didn't spend between 65 and 75? That's the crazy part about this. It's not practical to adjust later in life like that.
I will say, Chris, I haven't been to any events since COVID hit, but when I would go to events, we say this all the time, when you go to financial planning events, when you go have lunch, it's like being at a wedding. Everyone sits at round tables with about 8 to 12 people, yeah, so you can all talk.
Right, exactly.
And that is exactly it. And I don't say much. Y'all probably find that hard to believe. I really do sit there and shut up unless someone says something so egregious I can't help myself. But I usually just sit there and shut up. And y'all probably don't believe me, but I truly do. But there are people chatting, Chris, about exactly that. That, well, they monitor it, and then every X amount of years into retirement, if the portfolio has grown more than their projections, they tell their clients that they can start spending a little bit more money. And I cringe at that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Again, and you're talking
it's
to
like
someone,
they're ignoring
folks,
aging happens.
Exactly. How do you know in 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, your client's going to have the health, inclination, desire, and abilities to do that? How do you know they're even going to be alive? Yeah. Retirement, folks, is our last third of our lives. Keep that in mind. And it doesn't end well. Sometimes it ends well, but for the most part, it doesn't. And at some point in time, it's not like for 30 years you're going to be young and healthy, then all of a sudden, poof, you're gone. At some point in time, could be 5 days into retirement, could be 5 years, could be 10, 15 years, who knows? But at some point, something's going to happen, and a lot of what you used to do and enjoy, you can't do anymore. And what you're left with is the rest of your life regrets. Why didn't I do this when I had the chance? Why didn't I do this when I had the chance? What the heck good is it with me dying with this money now? Yada, yada, yada. So I cringe at that, but that is true. That's how a lot of advisors compensate for Monte Carlo's shortcomings of not spending enough. Yep. Well, we're going to tell our clients in the last phase of their life, Chris, what we call the go-go phase, when they have the health inclination, desire, and ability to spend money on fun things, we're going to tell them not to.
Right.
But
wait,
we'll evaluate it later.
Yeah.
When they may not have the health inclination, desire, and ability to spend their money on fun things, we're going to tell them it's okay.
Now, there is one way to overcome this and ignore everything that we do and take a traditional approach and still spend all the money without restriction that you could ever dream of spending, and that is save such an enormous amount that you don't have to worry about any of this. There are those people. Most of those people don't listen to this podcast. Most of the people who listen to this podcast and who contact us are those who have saved. And they've built up a nice nest egg, but it isn't so enormous that they could just spend frivolously without thought at any level they could imagine and never worry about anything. That takes a big number. Many people out there, well, not as a percentage of the United States, but some people out there have that. Their issues are different. They're managing estate issues and tax issues and this and that. And, you know, that's where their focus should be and help should be. If you've got a good amount of money, but not massive, that's where it becomes tricky. That's where you can squeeze as much juice from the orange as possible if you take the right approach. And if that's what your goal is, you can take, but you can't just squeeze indiscriminately. You've got to put some thought into this, put some protections in like we talked about, and then squeeze away at it day one of retirement. Don't wait and see how it goes and then start squeezing at 75 or 80. It's too darn late.
Exactly. Well, folks, hopefully you enjoyed this and you got a little out of it. Again, this article was very light, very fluffy, was not a deep dive, but I thought I would use this, and Chris and I rather would use this, as a way to, again, reiterate some of our beliefs with retirement planning. So a lot of you are do-it-yourselfers, you have no intention of working with anyone. You might want to consider some of our approach and our thoughts, though. We're not saying our approach is superior, that our approach is right. We just happen to believe in it. We wear it on our sleeves. We let everybody see it. We let everybody hear about it. We feel confident. We like it. But it doesn't mean it's for everyone. And if you are an advisor, listen to this, and you prefer one of the other approaches, we're not saying you're necessarily wrong. We're just trying to explain to people why we do things the way we do. To us, that is so important. I think a lot of advisors in the industry, Chris, concentrate on the how. You go talk to one, they're going to explain to you how they're going to do this, how they're going to do that, how they're going to do this. I think they should be explaining the why. Why am I going to do this? Why do I believe in the 4% rule? Or why do I believe in this? Should be getting the whys just as much as the how. And when we looked at retirement from the standpoint of why, we didn't like what we saw. We didn't like seeing people dying with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, not using it. My father, I told you all about this once. My dad told me some of the most miserable people in his retirement community, I forget what he called them. He called them Debbie Downers. Mm-hmm. He said, were the Debbie Downers. And I asked him, Chris, I always remember we were at LePage Seafood in Fall River, Mass, talking. And I said, what's a Debbie Downer? And he said, Debbie Downers are the people who have money, son, but can't spend it. And he was just going on to tell me that there are people in the community, they just can't do what they wanted to do, and they have money, and they complain that their family is just waiting for them to die and everything. It got kind of sad when he was explaining all that. But what he was trying to get me to understand, and he told me to say this on your podcast, that amassing money and not being able to spend it is sometimes just as horrendous as the people who have no money in a roundabout way. It's not an exact, but I understood what he was saying. So it's all these things that got Chris and I thinking that there's got to be a different way of looking at things. And it's just kind of the way we believe. Anyways, that's what we wanted to chat about today. Do you have anything else you want to add, Chris?
No, I think people got a review if they've heard it before, and if you're fresh to the podcast, a good, you know, how we think about this and why we do the things the way that we do. Oftentimes, we're talking about the how we're doing things. This was a why show, I think, for the most part. So hopefully, it was helpful and interesting to those of you who listened through the whole thing. We do appreciate you listening. We do appreciate your ideas for the show. So if you want to send in ideas or send in a question for our Q&A podcast, which also plays once a week, opposite from this show, the way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com, jimhelps.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can submit any questions or comments. You can learn a little bit more about us on that website. You can also, if you want to send directly to Jim any questions or suggestions, his email is jim@jimhelps.com. And yeah, he likes hearing from you. I like him forwarding the emails that he chooses to. Anything else you want to say, Jim?
No, that's about it. Everybody, I can't say have a good Memorial. Yeah. Well, I could say you have a good Memorial Day.
I'll try to have one and stay dry, and I hope everyone else who's listening to this had a nice Memorial Day weekend.
Right, exactly. Hope you all had a good Memorial Day. Yeah, Chris, try to stay dry up there Sunday and Monday. Don't get too wet.
Will do. We'll be back with everybody next week.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.